I just came back from 2 days of talks with the Thai government. We saw 7 ministers, even the prime minister. They didn't mention ASEAN once.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. My guest this episode is none other than Hans Vriens, managing partner of Vriens & Partners, a Singapore-based consulting and advisory firm specializing in government affairs, public policy, and political risk analysis. Hans is the quintessential Asia insider. He's been roaming the region for close to 3 decades, building a network, insights, and ultimately a business to assist foreign multinationals in their quest to penetrate the oftentimes opaque and always mysterious markets of Southeast Asia. Like his Dutch forerunners, Hans is an explorer of sorts. Instead of spices, however, he trades in information. His outposts are satellite offices scattered across the region, staffed with market specialists and industry analysts. For any global CEO bent on Asia market penetration, Hans and his team are there to interpret new government legislation, regulatory changes, or any other issue that threatens to curtail or delay growth plans. Hans and I first met in the early 1990s when we both worked as Hong Kong-based journalists. While there, he served as president of the Foreign Correspondents Club. Eventually, he, like I, left journalism, opting to build out his resume as a consultant and advisor. He started this journey by moving to a well-regarded boutique by the name of Political and Economic Risk Consultancy. He later jumped to APCO Worldwide, where he served as vice chairman for the group's Southeast Asia operations. Then in 2009, he set up his own shop, hiring a team of political economic experts throughout the region. To hear more about his efforts and exploits, let's get our conversation underway. I start off by asking him to tell us a little bit about his business and how he's helping companies gain access to markets across the region.
We are headquartered in Singapore. We have 8 offices around Southeast Asia. We have 100 people, 70 full-time at the moment, 30 senior advisors. We really specialize in is helping companies, big companies from US, Europe, Japan, but more and more from the region, from Malaysia, from Thailand, from Indonesia, help them understand how public policy is made, how governments think and work. Because don't underestimate, working in a company and trying to work with a government, the governments and companies basically, they live in almost parallel universes and they will never meet.
Yeah, and this is interesting. It's almost the tagline to your business is navigating the politics of business. It's really a nuanced form of making sure that organizations, corporations, and governments can find a common language, common ground. Is that right?
That is exactly what it is. Yeah. Where can they find alignment? And that is much more challenging than companies often think. They think sometimes they're just about, let my CEO have a meeting with the prime minister and then they can fix it. But that's never how it is. Because why is that? Because the prime minister will look at his... I mean, where's the trust between the two? They've never met. They come from different universes. And if the CEO would suggest something, it's very likely that the prime minister will look at his advisors who are in the meeting and say, they've never talked to us. What are they? We don't know about this.
Is this unique to Southeast Asia? I mean, this idea of the way that you approach, the way you engage, the way you build trust, or is this just doing business anywhere ex your native country?
I think to some extent, it's not entirely different in probably in South America, but what is different here is that these are all young countries. Nearly all countries in Southeast Asia have a colonial history. In many countries, the founding father has just left the scene. Think about Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore and Mahathir in Malaysia, who, by the way, is trying to make a comeback.
Yeah, I saw that. He can't stay away.
He's only 93.
He's still a young man.
Often these countries are somewhat inward-looking, and the way these governments and the civil service think about the world, of course, is so different than senior executives from the US, Japan, or Europe.
Entirely. I mean, you know, for-profit organizations have goals, targets, timelines, you know, pressures, shareholders, and they need to get things done. Now, governments are, well, we will be here forever, and we may, you know, shift and change with time and politics, but basically, that we make the rules, and nobody's going to force us to break down those barriers or bring down those barriers if we choose not to. And this seems to be a common source of frustration for many corporations operating in Southeast Asia.
It is, but in the end, we have to understand the government, the governments make, they make the rules. Yeah. That's why they govern. And companies, so what's the challenge is for many companies is to find common ground and help governments, work with governments, build trust and help them understand why what they want to do can be very well aligned with the policies and the objectives of governments. Because the paradox is, many of these governments are actually quite focused, or they say they are focused on attracting foreign direct investment, attracting technology to further develop. Because, I mean, look at Southeast Asia. Many of these countries are still relatively underdeveloped. I mean, the average GDP per head is only $4,000. So there's a long way to go. And if you go outside the capital, like for example in Myanmar, outside Yangon, you immediately back in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, and there's arguably a case for being mildly protectionist in those early years. You're trying to, as China did, you know, it was trying to protect those burgeoning companies and organizations, trying to protect and develop jobs. They don't want to have their assets owned and controlled by foreign entities. So there's reasonable, a justification for this. But as companies and countries grow and as economies evolve, there's need for foreign direct investment. And many of these countries are, in fact, you know, capital starved.
Absolutely. So if you look at Thailand, I mean, Thailand has basically been built on foreign direct investment. And so is Singapore. Mm. So, and Singapore has done rather well. So really, really, and a country like Indonesia is much more ambivalent about this. I think especially the Javanese who rule Indonesia have always said see foreign direct investment more as a zero-sum game, meaning if the foreigners have it, something is wrong, and how can we get it back?
Right.
That's not necessarily helps really in the development of the country. But even Vietnam is really the government may not always have the right policies, and I give some examples of that, but they very much, the Communist Party really understands that their long-term survival will depend on their ability to achieve high economic growth. Mm. And how can you do that? And how can you get the right technologies? Only by having foreign companies invest in your country. By the way, Samsung is probably the biggest single investor in South Korea, and nearly all Samsung products are produced over there.
Yeah, it's the largest investor in Vietnam or South Korea?
No. Samsung is the largest foreign investor in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, yeah. Right. So, I mean, which is a massive, I mean, they're a brand unto themselves, a global brand, and one of the most successful brands in Asia.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but finding that alignment across many sectors can be very challenging, especially if there are issues with local interests, local companies that try to protect their position.
So Hans, what's the right way to do this? A multinational comes to you and says, I really am intrigued and interested in breaking into Myanmar. It's this burgeoning economy, interesting, you know, political situation, but nevertheless, large rising middle class. How can I get in? What do you say to them? What's the process you would take them through in order to start to position themselves in a market, any given market?
Sure. So it's either it starts like that, or there's a certain policy issue a company is facing, and sometimes that company can have been in that country for a century.
Mm. So as a pharmaceutical company, it could be you can't distribute your drug for some reason. There need to be local clinical trials or something of that sort.
Yeah. It can be any sector.
Yeah.
Or it can even be, like we see more and more, that there is no regulatory framework. Mm. If you are in the ride-hailing business or e-commerce, all these governments are busy trying to look at what the right regulatory framework is. So how do you do that? Okay, yeah. So first of all, it's not about having a few meetings.
Right. It's not a meeting.
No. Yeah. A meeting is not a problem.
Call the prime minister. I have a few things I want to tell him. It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. So we very much are in favor of a bottom-up approach. You have to work with the bureaucrats, the technocrats, who actually draft the regulations.
Several rungs down.
Absolutely. The paradox is the lower, the better.
Okay.
Because it's another reason. So we have clients who thought about making a major investment and thought about we should really see the prime minister first. And it's often important to stay away from politicians because politicians have very different drivers. They have to win the next elections and they also have to finance the election campaign. And that's not necessarily something we can help them with.
Right. So the idea of seeing the prime minister, having that meeting, as you say, is it just kind of the corporate idea that when I want to get stuff done, company to company, corporate to corporate, I just meet with the other CEO and that's how I get things done. Is it that they're just not geared to understanding governments fundamentally and how they operate and how they basically develop regulations and legislation?
I think that is a challenge. Mm. That is a real challenge. But of course, hey, if the global CEO comes to town, you also want him probably to meet the prime minister.
Yeah.
But then you would like to make sure that meeting is a success. And that can only be a success if a lot of work has been done beforehand to build understanding. And first of all, a company really needs to understand how public policy is made in a specific country and what the thinking of different government departments are about this issue.
Yeah.
So only then can you start thinking about how can we as a company align ourselves with the policies and the policy direction this country has.
Well, this is where Vriends and Partners comes in. You do the coaching, the development, you help guide them, you help explain the workings, the levers of government, and get them prepped and ready for those ultimate engagements. Is that right?
Absolutely. And with both sides, we have to also help the governments understand who these companies are, because they also have no idea. Once a meeting with the government official, and it was about probably the biggest oil company in the world, they said, we never heard of them. Who are they? So it has no meaning to them.
Yeah.
And by the way, even if they've heard of the name, it doesn't mean that they really understand what they do or what their business model is.
I'm Steve Stein, and my guest is Hans Vriends, managing partner of Vriends & Partners, which specializes in government affairs, public policy, and political risk analysis. More in a moment. This is Inside Asia, and you're listening to my conversation with Hans Vriends, managing partner of Vriends & Partners, a Singapore-based boutique specializing in political economic risk and government affairs throughout Southeast Asia. I started off the second part of our conversation by asking him about ASEAN integration. What is it? How did it start? And where does it stand today?
ASEAN was really set up in the mid-60s more as an anti-communist bloc. Eh? Think about we were the Indochina War, Vietnam. ASEAN has evolved. And by the way, ironically, it is now Vietnam is one of its biggest proponents.
Still communist.
Still communist.
However, they see the virtues of commerce.
Absolutely. And they see the virtues of having an ASEAN bloc that in their mind and hope will be able to stand up against their neighbor to the north, China.
Right. And that's one of those big driving forces, isn't it? Forming a bloc to basically hold their own against a very strong regional power.
Absolutely. But it's very it's difficult to see how not all ASEAN member states are aligned with regard to how they view the rise of China. Mm. But coming back to ASEAN integration, if I may say. So Because from a political organization, it has really tried to integrate. But what does it mean? ASEAN has been very successful in lowering trade barriers around Southeast Asia, among all 10 member states. And it's also not, and that is possible, and the leaders like to play golf and agree on that. That is not so technical.
Yeah, trade has been the tip of the arrow.
Yes, but okay, having done that, what's the next phase? So the next phase is the government leaders have agreed on establishing the ASEAN Economic Community. And what they say is we will achieve a free flow of goods, free flow of services, free flow of investment, free flow of skilled labor. And so this is very ambitious. This sounds almost like the EU. So ambitious. And the problem is this is not going to happen.
And why is it not?
Because there is no political will. And there's no political will to create the institutions to achieve this. Because this is, in the end, just like the EU, it will be about pooling of sovereignty, having a supranational or partially supranational organization or organizations that would make sure this could happen. Unfortunately, so the EU has two bodies. The EU Commission have a staff of 30,000. ASEAN has a secretariat. They're just there to make the minutes. They have 300 staff.
A little bit of a difference.
A small difference. And then, but beside that, I mean, despite all this, ASEAN has been a success. But this is one bridge too far. And why is that? As I said earlier, these are young nations. They all have a colonial past. Pooling of giving up part of your sovereignty. Just look at the UK. It's very, very sensitive. And why would you outsource that? And in the EU, Europe community tried to commit suicide twice before, after the Second World War, they finally saw the light and understood that Germany and France really had, the economies had to be integrated. And they agreed on setting up of the first supranational body, the European Coal and Steel Community. But this was supranational. This is a revolutionary step. Yeah. The national governments had no say over this. And in ASEAN, and then they also set up the European Court of Justice. There's European law that's of a higher order than national law. So the European Court of Justice can instruct any member government, even France, to implement certain regulations have to be implemented into national law. There's nothing of this in ASEAN. It's also not going to happen.
Yeah. So as impressive as all that was, it's also come with its issues. And obviously, sure. Brexit and everything else, there's this kind of move towards, nationalism once again. But very impressive. But then you make a really interesting point, which is it's a level of development and maturity of a government. And there are some legacy issues that actually prevent or countries from thinking that giving up a percentage of sovereignty is a good idea.
So all member states at the moment are very internally domestic focused. I just came back from 2 days of talks with the Thai government. We saw 7 ministers, even the prime minister. They didn't mention ASEAN once.
Yeah, which is amazing, isn't it?
But it's the same in Indonesia. Nobody will talk about ASEAN.
Well, but there's also this movement. Singapore is now the chair of ASEAN for 1 year.
Yep.
And they said, for us, we're not going to be overly ambitious.
Yep.
They've stated that they're going to focus on e-commerce.
Yep.
Why e-commerce?
Because if there's one part of the economy where ASEAN can really leapfrog and where almost its lack of infrastructure is an advantage, and you can be stuck in traffic all day in Jakarta, can be really the digital economy, e-commerce. And there are so many startups in the region that are really focusing on this. So having the right regulatory framework for e-commerce around ASEAN, that would be a major success.
And everybody has something to gain from that. I mean, the idea right now with digital commerce, you can't lay claims to certain revenue and therefore tax it. But if they came up with a tax regime that monitored and managed that, assuming they could get there, everyone could gain from this, couldn't they?
In theory, yes. But especially on taxes, I think it's very sensitive. But at least, so what's very important is that the different governments have a good understanding about what is required to make the digital economy and e-commerce a success. And viewing things like data as sovereign, data can't leave the country, as some Indonesian officials think, is just hilarious. It can never work.
Right.
Yeah?
And so how would this e-commerce integration work? It means that it could be hosted in any member nation within ASEAN, and that would be legitimate, and therefore wouldn't have to be hosted in your country specifically.
Yes, to make it much easier to do this around the region and be able to move goods and services in a much easier way than is done at the moment.
What's the probability of them getting at least the framework for that in place in 1 year?
No. So the Singapore government hopes to announce the framework in August of this year. The question really is what will be in the framework and to what extent will the different member states implement that framework.
So it'll be up to everybody independently and unilaterally decide to join or not to join.
Welcome to ASEAN.
Yeah, okay. So there's no supra organization that's going to say we've agreed and therefore we're all doing it.
That's exactly my point.
Okay.
So it's up to everybody to do this, and let's hope ASEAN has not been really very strong in securing the implementation of regulations.
Yeah. Of course, against investors and private sector and corporations are all wildly enthusiastic about the possibility because it makes their lives easier. You know, one regime, never one currency, but at least kind of like, that would be a real stretch.
Yes.
But also free flow of labor is one. Labor issues are always, particularly skilled labor, is a problem. Every country has its limitations on how many approvals they're going to give for, people living in different countries. If you could create that free flow of labor, that could alleviate a lot of the big issues that multinational and other corporations face in Asia, right?
Absolutely. So there is already quite a lot of labor from around the region, but this is a very sensitive issue as well. So there is an agreement to recognize more diplomas, but this is not really, really happening. So Thailand just agreed that architects, people who have a degree in architecture from around ASEAN can now work in Thailand, but there are two caveats. They have to be Thai and speak Thai. So I don't know how many Thai nationals graduated from a Philippine university in architecture.
Right, which I think we agreed is zero. But that's the way that politics just manages. So it's the left hand says one thing and the right hand does another. And that's the way that they're kind of at least giving the appearance of integration, but not fully enforcing it.
But to some extent, this is also understandable. Here we have countries. I mean, there's a risk of a middle income trap. The education systems, with the exception of Singapore, are underdeveloped, are underfunded. I mean, there is a lot of underemployment and unemployment still. So, of course, governments want to make sure they want to protect their own populations first. I mean, almost one third of Indonesians between 15 and 24 are neither employed nor in school.
Yeah, these are serious. These are serious fundamental economic issues.
Absolutely.
So if you look then on, they had said by 2015, they were hoping to have, at least a plan towards integration. They're all patting each other's on the backs and say, in principle, we're in agreement. But in fact, nothing really is going to happen. So now they've reset the target to 2025. Is that right?
So they actually said they have achieved it, but in true ASEAN style, then they said we're going to really achieve it, not sure how it's possible, in 2025. And this is still too optimistic.
All right, Hans, thank you so much for taking time. Wonderful to see you again. And we will be checking with you from month to month to see how things are going.
Thank you very much, Steve. Most welcome.
This is Inside Asia, and that was my conversation with consummate Asia insider Hans Vriens, managing partner of Vriens & Partners, a boutique firm specializing in political economic risk analysis and government relations in Southeast Asia. Here's my takeaway from this week's discussion. Two key thoughts come to mind. The first has to do with the nature of his work. In this age of ubiquitous access to information, it's hard to believe that answers to most questions can't be found with a laptop and a few keystrokes. But this is Asia, and government policies and decision-making isn't always as transparent as one might hope. Relationships and networks count for something, and knowing who to ask is part of the poetry of operating in this part of the world. Vriens specializes in bridging the gap between foreign multinationals and Asian governments. He's a kind of marriage counselor, guiding two parties with mutual interests to a place of greater understanding. In some instances, the relationship is worn and tested and prone to the occasional tiffs. In other cases, the two parties are still getting to know each other. There's a strong attraction, but early signs of fatigue. Whatever the state of the relationship, Hans sits them down, talks it out, and strives for common ground. The second takeaway concerns ASEAN integration and the realization that we're a long way off from anything that looks anything like the European Union. As Hans explains it, ASEAN is a composition of emergent nations suspicious of anything that requires them to cede sovereignty. Both the will and the structure are in short supply. Everyone pays ASEAN integration lip service, but scratch beneath the surface and any substantive move in that direction appears unlikely at best. It's unfortunate in many ways, particularly at a time when China is turning the thumbscrews on Southeast Asia, upping its influence and looking to sway ASEAN countries to align more with them and less with the U.S. Without integration, China, and any other trading power for that matter, has a better chance of dividing and conquering. An ASEAN united front could go a long way in shoring up Southeast Asia's future political and economic prowess. This story is still being written, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.